wanted to make two quick announcements. And in a certain way, one is relevant to what I'm going to discuss here. There are two things coming up. I mean, I think people know generally that we have classes and strict political briefings Wednesday and Saturday. And, and also, actually, I don't know if people, everybody knows, we have this little, maybe a little, we also have on Sundays from about 11 till 3, what we call Mange Brigades, where people go through different kind, you know, generally it's Plato or philosophy, geometry, Gauss, Riemann, and then music. And then there are other things. Actually, I think everybody who's in the Shakespeare group, even though I erased it, there's a rehearsal tomorrow from 4 to 7. Okay? So, and everybody's supposed to be there. Now, however, we have two special things coming up. One is 2 weeks from yesterday. Actually, the most important one was a month from yesterday. 4 weeks from yesterday, I guess. Where we have a national conference, which we hold in Virginia, which is near our headquarters in Washington, just outside of Washington, D.C., and on the West Coast. And actually, we have the West Coast section of the National Conference is going to be at the Pasadena Hilton. So that occurs President's Day weekend. And actually, besides the fact that there will be keynote addresses by Lyndon LaRouche and Helga LaRouche and others, including presentations from representatives of the International LaRouche Youth Movement. There's also an intensive series of classes that follows for about a day and a half or 2 days. I guess usually it's Tuesday and Wednesday. So basically, from Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, on President's Day weekend and slightly beyond, we have an international conference where people will be at the conferences from Europe, from South America, from across the United States. And we will be engaged in a fairly intensive discussion about the policies that are needed globally for the next 50 years ahead. The next 50 years where we're going to have, you know, to bring about 3 to 4 billion people who live in poverty, including in the United States, but obviously preeminently in Asia, in Africa, and so forth. And what kinds of policies, what kind of management of global existence does that take? And how do nations collaborate to bring that kind of development about? Because people come from different backgrounds, different nations, different languages, and the idea is to find what common interest and what common sense of humanity can be the basis for the proper form of dialogue as compared to what Bush did on Thursday. Okay? Which wasn't exactly, first of all, a dialogue. And secondly, didn't offer anything to anybody other than a small circle of friends. Or maybe a small circle of born-again whatevers. You know? So that conference will take place, and there's an enormous amount of time at that conference for discussion, for direct questions to Lyndon LaRouche and others in the hallways and the byways and so on and so forth. And in this case, I think following a conference that occurred in Europe a couple of weeks ago, you will be in the history in the middle of making a certain kind of decision about history, about what way this country is going to go, or at least attempting to chart out a path for directing an alternative to this administration, an alternative that has largely been galvanized by the willingness of somebody like LaRouche to stand out and to stand for certain principles that other people would tend to capitulate on. Secondly, there will be a opportunity to discuss amongst people how to carry these policies out. Now, in 2 weeks, we'll have a cadre school. Now, that's in some ways preparatory. We'll be going on Friday, probably Friday around noontime, because it's about a four-hour drive up the coast here, midway between Oakland and between the Bay Area and L.A., where we'll spend Friday evening, Saturday, and Sunday morning engaged in a discussion of Lynn, of the economic, of the philosophical epistemological basis for what the LaRouche movement has been able to accomplish. Now, this includes discussion of principles of music, science, history, economics, and so forth. And I would certainly invite anybody here who wants to get a sense of what we can do and the kinds of ways in which these ideas develop to take that amount of time, probably a total of, you know, a little more than 48 hours. Okay? I mean, there is a cost because we provide housing, transportation, and food, which runs about $50 for the weekend. It's somewhat negotiable, but we certainly encourage people to do as close to that as they can. And we've had an enormous amount of success. Look, many people have come to these things, hundreds of people, probably hundreds and hundreds of people. Okay? And I think many people have joined the political movement, the Philosophical Association, and others, I hope, got something out of it that, you know, they may remember somewhere down the road. But for those of you who have any idea that we need to do something about the way the culture is moving, about an opportunity to shape history that has a real future to it, then I would say you should make every effort to be there. I guarantee you, you'll get something out of it besides the food. Now, what I want to do, in one sense, what I'll do, I'm going to attempt to go over a little bit tonight for a while, and we'll take questions and whatnot, is something that I will probably continue explicitly at the cadre school, or maybe at one session in between, because there's no way that this can be done in one session. So hopefully people might, if anybody gets anything out of it, they'll attend future sessions of the cadre school just to find out how this turns out. But anyway, because I want to look at a little bit more, maybe you might say a little more difficult area, or the more difficult ideas. So they're not esoteric. Sometimes when I say difficult, probably what I mean, it requires a certain amount of concentration on things that, you know, might be a little bit not you're not used to thinking about. Okay? Because concentration really, is the essence of thinking. If people think that when you have an idea, the whole thing is, are you smart enough? Whatever that's supposed to mean. Okay? Yeah, really, this is the kind of thing that more or less applies to non-human thinking. Because human thinking is always characterized by a quality of generation of an idea. Addressing a problem and being able to think in terms of how that problem might be solved. What kinds of concepts do I need to solve the problem? And what most people think about being smart is basically learning a trick. It's sort of like a smart horse. A smart horse is a horse you can teach a lot of tricks to. And that's a smart horse. Or a smart dog is a dog that can be trained a lot of different things. Now, really, if you think about it, the way most people think about smart, when you think about the smart kid in the class, or the smart student, or the smart guy in the neighborhood, it's somebody whom a teacher can usually teach a lot of different tricks. They're quick. Sometimes it does actually express a certain amount of native intelligence. But it's just a certain kind of quickness. For example, you have this problem, particularly you tend to get this manifestation with people who are good at mathematics. But I'll give you another better example in a second. But are good at mathematics. Because when you ask them if they know what they're doing, if they know where these ideas came from, how the person that made the discovery, they often don't know. In fact, what they'll tell you is, well, no, this is how you manipulate the symbols. This is how you treat the equation. And sometimes you get a certain kind of person who has a facility. Sometimes they see things. As I say, there's a certain kind of native intelligence, but often it involves nothing more than seeing that if you want to prove something, you know, how do you prove that A plus B equals B plus A? Well, there's usually a certain number of rules about how you can substitute things or manipulate them. And half the time, the person doesn't even know quite exactly what the point is. Like, why wouldn't A plus B equal B plus A? You know, why does the change in position, why would you think a change in position means anything? So you have to have already something embedded in your mind that it might be the case that if I just change the position in the operation of addition, something funny happens. Well, then you realize that the way in which this gets proven in some cases, for those of you who have had the new math, it may work, right? But, you know, A represents some number. So all numbers are represented as successors. It's 1 plus 1 plus 1 up to N, depending on what the number is. Okay? And then if you say, well, A is some, and they usually index it, but let's say we'll just do it the simple way, 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 up to plus N, plus 1, N times, and B is another number of the same type, and then you repeat those symbols on the other side, and you realize that all you've done is put a plus sign in between them, well then, those two are always going to be exactly equal. So you've used the definition of the number, a certain definition of the addition operation, and this is considered to be smart. Well, basically, it's somebody who's learned a simple trick. It's a simple conversion of a symbol into something you've been told is the equivalent of the symbol. Now, one good example of this stuff, by the way, is you get people who are good at computers. Now, there's a perfect case. Because most people who are good at computers haven't the faintest idea what's going on inside the computer. In fact, it might be a little unfair to say, but I would venture to say most people, even in the computer sciences, though, you know, it depends on where you are in it, have only the foggiest idea how the programs work. They're just told, here's what the program is. Here's the handful of programs you can work. You got an operating system. You got applications. You got this, that, and the other thing. And you're given basically an outline of how the programs mesh in a certain way and what your operating system can take. But most people have the foggiest idea how the computer works, and, you know, let alone the hardware. And what do most people do these days when they want to find the answer to a question?
Google,
right? That we all know. You go to the computer. I watch this. It's a fascinating... It's a fascinating... Plus, it always amazes me that people think, for some reason, even more than a book. You know, all right, it's bad enough. You read a book, and you say, well, you know, all the founding fathers were all a bunch of slave-owning bastards. You say, well, how do you know that? I read it in a book. Well, wait a minute. I'm not arguing that you didn't read it in the book. Okay. Who wrote the book? How do you know the book is true? Now, ironically enough, I found that in general, people will question a book, maybe because they see the name of the author, I don't know, more than they'll question the computer. Because people get on the Google and they say, oh, you know, I found out a list of things, I looked at them, and therefore I know the history of something. Well, how do you know it? Well, I found it on the internet. I found it on the Google. I saw this as an interesting example of this. It came up on something people are working with. That's a serious question. If you look up, we had a videotape, but if you look up on the internet, supersonic flight, and you look at the history of supersonic flight, you'll get the fact that there were a lot of problems in creating an airplane that could fly through the sound barrier. That's there. You'll generally get sometimes eyewitness experiences of pilots that are interesting. You might even get a little description of what goes on the wing of the plane and some of the things that went into solving the problem. But in general, you get a story that's completely made up. Okay, the story usually is that there was some kind of competition between the Americans and the British. The Germans were interesting, but they didn't get anywhere. Besides that, they were Nazis. They had weird ideas. And, you know, of course, the one thing that bothers you when you watch this is that you'll notice that in general, the German designs look more like jet aircraft today than the first American airplane that goes through the sound barrier. Okay, now you're also told that the British, maybe they could have done it, you know, who did it first, et cetera, et cetera. Now, all this is essentially not true. It leaves out a whole history of what really happened in supersonic flight. You can do this on a million different things. Who discovered gravity? Isaac Newton. Now, that's one that seems very authoritative, even before computers. Okay? It's not true. Now, you'll get a little better thing on something like the calculus. You'll get, well, the calculus was sort of jointly discovered by Newton and Leibniz, but maybe Leibniz plagiarized it, but we don't want to say those kinds of things about him because he's a well-known philosopher. Okay? Not true. All kinds of things like this. But people think if you get on the Google and it's on the internet, it must be true. You know, actually, even worse, I've noticed, people think that if it's in a chat room, it's true. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
It's sort of like if people sort of think of the chat room as an eyewitness report of some kind. You know? No, it's just not the case. Now, if you know how the internet works, there's no confirming truth. There's no regulating principle. Anybody can put anything on it, virtually. So the question here of how do you know something? What's an idea? Is kind of a fundamental question. Now, maybe to talk about an idea is a little bit. What's a principle? What's a scientific discovery? See, people will often say, "I don't understand what a musical idea is," because they think of music as just kind of a sequence of sounds that you like or you don't like. And the idea that you attach an idea to music is a little strange. Or if they do, they'll say, well, it's really a concoction of things that I like, how I feel about it. In fact, okay, there are ideas. I guarantee you, when Mozart or Beethoven or Bach wrote a piece of music, they were basing it on an idea. They were communicating an idea. But perhaps more interesting is where people think they know what an idea is, let's say a scientific idea, a geometrical idea. Is it really an idea? Is it a thought? Is a triangle an idea? Well, most people, what do they think when they think of a triangle? They think of an image of a three-sided object, maybe, of any particular set of relationships. Well, that's not a triangle. Or that's not the idea of a triangle. Because presumably when you talk about a triangle, you're talking about a whole array of things, all of which are triangles, not one image. Not one visual imagined object. So for example, here's an interesting question, which I might be giving away, but I think most people would admit, even if some people want to get picky, you know, about my drawing, those are triangles, or at least they're an effort to draw a triangle. But here's an interesting question. Is that a triangle? Well, it's all those things, but the real question is that really an angle? Is that a triangle? Now, one interesting thing is how many degrees do most people think a triangle has? Well, how many degrees added up in the three angles of a triangle?
30.
Some triangles, but right? The standard answer, whether people are cleverer than that, the standard answer is 180 degrees, you know, because you were taught that in your geometry class. If that's true, if we work from that standpoint, then this is not a triangle, because it doesn't have 180 degrees. Or we could do we could do something slightly different, and we could draw this triangle, which may even look stranger, just to give you some perspective on it. Nope, so I'm not terrible. I never took graphic arts. Do it that way, all right? All right. Anyway, you know, that's a triangle that might have 270 degrees in it. Okay? Now, are they all triangles? Well, at least, here's the point. You may know, yes, they are all triangles. They're triangles on different surfaces. But now we have a whole different idea of what a triangle is. It's not just a three-sided object, because these are not straight sides. It's not just three angles. We have to develop an idea. We have to develop some principle that we're going to apply to our notion of geometry. We have to apply some conception that's a larger principle, a larger idea. Or you take the classic Platonic cases. You know, the classic case that people are given in, you know, what's a horse? Now, actually, that could be a tricky case. Like, is a zebra a horse? Is a burro a horse? Well, you know. Who would have ever thought, when you talk about a horse, as people think say now, if it mean a zebra is not a horse, because a zebra and a horse can't interbreed. Right? So it's not what it looks like, apparently. Is a mule a horse? Now that's interesting, because a mule is a cross between a horse and a donkey. Except it's generally infertile, so people say, well, it's a hybrid, it's not really a horse. Now, on the other hand, there are a lot of mules if you bumped into them. You might say, well, you might mistake it for a horse. So, what concepts are we dealing with? What's an idea? Now, let me make this a little bit more important than to just say, well, there's all these different kinds of problems. Because one form that this took historically, philosophically, is an idea, the way this has been talked about in the history of philosophy, has some universal characteristic. It's a universal. It applies to a whole array of things, one idea. Now, this leads to all kinds of problems. How can you encompass all these different things in an idea? How do you do that? And to make it a little bit more real, as they say, human beings are very different, and there's about 6.2 billion odd human beings. Now, how, you know, you apply the concept of human being to all of them. That's an important principle. Not everybody really does that. Isn't it the case? Some people say, well, there are 6.2 billion people, but there are differences among them. Some people argue racial differences, ethnic differences. Well, there are differences. How do we know that those differences are not fundamental? What's the idea of a human being that defines something more fundamental, such that we can characterize all the differences as being part of one human species? and know it? What can we identify in human beings that makes them all essentially the same? I mean, you know, the variation among human beings is fairly broad, at least in terms of the outcome. And think of the different ways that people think of different languages, different historical backgrounds. I'm not just thinking physically. So what's an idea that says that we know as a matter of principle that you can rigorously prove? And this is not just a sentiment. In other words, okay, I'm a loving human being. I look at all these differences, but I know that I love them all. They're all human. They're all like me. That's fine. Maybe you had a good upbringing and you think that way. But the problem becomes, how do you make that a knowable thought, a provable thought, to a more egregious person? And how do you know when you talk to that person that you're right? How do you prove that quality? See, my whole point is, it is provable. In fact, probably that's something that's more provable than a lot of things that people think are less provable, or more provable. It's more provable than certain apparent mathematical truths and certainties. But you have to have a sense of what an idea is. How do you prove these kinds of things? What really is a universal principle? What's a real thought as compared to a fragment of a thought? See, a firmly held partial thought is not a thought. It's not an idea. Or we might say a firmly held opinion. A deeply held opinion is not necessarily a true thought, a true idea. Something that you've been told over and over again is true because it's traditionally held to be true is not necessarily true. That you have to have some idea of how do you know these things. What is the history of the human species that demonstrates that certain ideas are true? Because really, ideas are proven in human history, in the relationship that human beings have to the universe, have to other human beings. Now, the reason I'm taking this route is that when we deal with human history, with politics today, we have to be able to demonstrate that certain events occurred as we say they occurred, and we have to demonstrate that if we forecast something, we say this is where we're headed, this is where the world is going. That we have some basis for knowing that hypothesis is accurate. It's something you want to base your actions on. Something you want to base your communication with other human beings on. Now, one of the more interesting things to look at, and you saw some of this, I think, earlier in the briefing, is that one of the things that LaRouche has been able to do is to characterize, partly by his economic forecasting, but characterize the historical events of the last 40 or 50 years. And to give us a sense of why we're here. What do we face when we face a Bush administration? This is not just a question of whether you like George W. Bush and he looks this way and that way, and, you know, it's kind of hard to take the rhetoric sometimes. But you can know that he's wrong. You can know where his actions are coming from. We have a total collapse of the financial system. Bush is driven to do certain things in foreign policy, or let's say he was chosen to do certain things in foreign policy and in economic policy because of the nature of the way history is going. Now, what is the basis for that ability to economically forecast the direction that we're going, and therefore some of the historical determinants? Now, I think what this does is, in a sense, in order to get at this, you have to understand the way the human mind works. The way the human mind applies itself to knowledge about the universe.
And what is the history of the development of these things shown us? Let me give you an interesting example. One of the things I'm going to talk about, or give you some preliminary idea of, which we can deal with a little bit further, is Georg Cantor. Now, Cantor is a guy who he's called a mathematician. He doesn't call himself a mathematician. He wrote something that we translated in 1976 called The Concept of the Transfinite. It's interesting what the subtitle of this is when he writes it. It's not a mathematical treatise as such. If I can see this. The subtitle is A Mathematical Philosophical Study in the Theory of the Infinite. And he says, in presenting these pages to the public, I will not leave unmentioned that I wrote them principally for two circles of readers, for philosophers who have followed the development of mathematics up to the most recent period, and for mathematicians who are familiar with the most important older writings and more recent works in philosophy. So it's not mathematics in the way people think of mathematics. It's what kinds of ideas allow us, in some sense, to measure the world, to act on the world. What's the nature of those ideas, and what is it that we do? Now, in the introduction to this, people often ask, you know, how much has LaRouche changed his ideas? And wasn't there some things that he thought before he does it? But the answer is actually twofold, and I'll give you an example of this here. Fundamentally, we're dealing with the same philosophical outlook that you can trace over 50 years or whatever. There are things in the course of events that you discover, that you add to the store of knowledge, that allow you to improve based on that philosophical outlook, based on that methodological outlook, that allow you to improve what you know. But I think one of the more interesting things here is, he writes the preface to this translation. Lyndon LaRouche's pioneering achievements in Marxian economics and epistemology of the 1955 to 61 period were most significantly influenced by the conception of Riemann and Cantor underlined in this issue's contents. Not Riemann plus Cantor, but Riemann is understood retrospectively from the standpoint represented by Cantor's elaboration of the notion of the transfinite. Now, what LaRouche is looking at is not really Marxian economics. It's a correction of an outlook that was typical of the people who opposed the development of what we call today speculative financial capital, which typified by the collapse of the stock market, by the speculation in financial values in the real estate market. That in fact, what we're dealing with is a physical scientific conception of how the economy works, how it actually works, not how you're told that it works. And to understand this requires an understanding of principles that were developed by people like Bernard Riemann, who was a mathematician scientist of the middle of the 19th century, and Georg Cantor, and as applied in LaRouche's physical economic outlook. Because what is physical economy? When we talk about human society, the human being's relationship to the physical universe, all of it is really done through the physical economy. It's done through society. It's done through knowledge that's transmitted by society. It's done through the available technologies. It's done through the development of our relationship to the universe up to that point in time. Now, what happens is, how do we reproduce ourselves? We reproduce ourselves by reproducing the entirety of the physical economy that determines our relationship to the universe. people don't like to think this way, actually. People like to think in a much more immediate way. But you have to realize, in other words, people, you know, a family, what does a family think? It reproduces itself, first of all, biologically. And secondly, some members of the family go out, they earn a living, they earn a certain wage or something like that. That allows you to buy things which the family consumes. And that's how you reproduce yourself. Well, that outlook is in general how societies fade away. Because that's not how a family reproduces itself. There's a biological component, but fundamentally, the ability of the wage earner, however many there may be these days in the average family, four or five or six, the ability of the wage earner to function depends upon the physical production of the needs of that society by society as a whole. No individual goes out today and somehow manages to gather together what the family needs to survive. You need electrical power. You need buildings. You need roadways. You need transportation. How does all of that get built? How does all of that exist? If you're not thinking, from the standpoint of a simple wage earner, of a certain concept of the way in which society is organized to reproduce you, you're not capable of thinking about what policies you need to support, what policies you need to be in favor of to guarantee the success of your family's ability to function into the future, of your children and your grandchildren and so on and so forth. We used to use the example people have heard before of the worldwide cup of coffee. You know, ask yourself what it took. We could use anything in this room. But ask yourself what it takes to put a cup of coffee on your table in the morning, if you drink coffee. Now, these days, maybe green tea, I don't know. But people have different flavors these days. But whatever it is, coffee, take that as an example. Some of you may drink coffee, okay? What does it take to bring the coffee beans, the cup? Whatever was used to make the, to brew the coffee. And, of course, the joke is, if you really tried to trace this thing out, if you really included the ship, the truck, you realize it probably took most of the world to get that cup of coffee on your table. I mean, this is why people get very upset if you say, you have to worry about the welfare of other people. Say, no, I got to take care of my family. You get this fearful reaction. The truth of the matter is, it's not a matter of sentimentality. It's not a matter of provoking in somebody the right feeling. The truth of the matter is, that's what it takes for you to survive, at least at the level you want to survive now. And frankly, if you tried to go back the way some people do, say, well, I'm going back to a primitive condition. I'm going to go back. Well, go ahead. Live in a tree. Okay, go out. Because if somebody would really want to do it, you'd have to say, probably in infancy, I don't know. I mean, but anyway, not to be too brutal. Okay? You'd have to say to somebody at the age of 10 or 12 years old, here, we're going to dump you out there. You can live in nature. Somewhere, in the wilds of the Olympic Peninsula or something. I don't know what. The Mojave Desert. The forest. Go out and live on your own without anything that anybody else has produced. And I guarantee you, most people wouldn't make it. Human beings are not meant to make it that way. We're not exactly licky. We're not the fastest creatures in the world, so we can't run away from things all that well or catch things all that easily. Pound for pound, we're not impressive physically. Okay, I guess, somebody has argued we're built for long-distance running. I guarantee you, most predators would catch us long before we ran a long distance. They could catch us in a very short distance. Okay? But physically, this is not a species that made it on physical prowess. We made it one way. We made it because we're a species that learned to discover the way the universe works, number one. We created resources out of nothing. And number two, we learned to communicate it to other human beings. And in a sense, it's the second point that gave us an even greater quality of power. We not only can discover ideas, how to increase our ability to control and extract things from nature, to change our relationship to them. You may ask yourself an interesting thing in terms of the way things have to be understood historically. How did nuclear phenomena exist for human beings 1,000 years ago, or certainly even further back? Didn't exist. Why didn't it exist? We didn't have access to enough physical power to create various kinds of events that would tell us, that would lead us to hypothesize the nature of atomic activity. We weren't even dealing at that level. We were generally dealing with the object at a relatively gross level. We might have had some idea that you could break it down. We had no idea what the nature of these events were, and that by having a certain amount of control over them, we might make available to us all kinds of activity that otherwise isn't available in medicine or anything of that nature. So it's through the development of certain ideas that are ideas about the way in which the universe works, universal principles, conceptions of how the universe works, that are discovered by the individual human mind, and the ability to communicate them, to communicate the discovery of the idea, not the formula. Sometimes the formula may be something that a person can pick up. But what you really have to communicate is the way in which the discovery was made. You have to evoke a principle of discovery, or at least the idea that discovery is necessary, in other human beings. Now, because a lot of people people who have worked on this get fascinated by some of these words like the infinite and transfinite, which are useful. In fact, I would give you another word that's one maybe we'll develop in the course of some of these discussions. And not just transfinite, but ontological transfinite. That's a big word. What it means is the nature of existence, the nature of human identity, the nature of physical existence is in fact a concept of a transfinite sequence of transformations, ideas. But because an idea is never in the specific communication. An idea is never in a specific formula. And part of the point that I'll get at with this a little bit, we can do on this, the question of what Cantor's idea was, is that what you really get is that an idea, a universal principle as a discovery, is always outside all the formal expressions of it. But it is concrete and real. It's not mystical. It's the generation of an idea in the individual human mind and the ability to provoke other minds to generate that same idea. That's where that's what we mean really by the transfinite. That's human identity. And that's that principle is what orders all the particular manifestations of it you might see. And for example, in almost any case, when you really deal with an idea, even in some limited cases, you're dealing with how the object is generated. If you talk about a horse, it's the history of horses. It's not just the biological procreation. It's the principle by which this species came into existence in that form and what it does. And that's the only thing that's really an idea. for example, in geometry, what you're really dealing with is how do you construct, by what principles do you construct the object at hand? Then you get a much different idea. For example, take the question of a triangle. How do you construct, what happens when you use a certain principle, a certain set of actions to construct a certain object in that space, on that surface? It's that constructive activity and the principles that guide that constructive activity, which is the geometry of that space. And it's the way in which that construction relates to other surfaces. What happens when you take a triangle on a flat surface and move it to a curved surface? It's the relationship between those two that tells you the geometry of a triangle. It's the way in which it changes as it moves from surface to surface. It's not a fixed thing. What's the history of a human economy? The history of human species is the way in which the human species has changed its activity, its relationship to the universe, the way it has become to control more and more of the universe, and ultimately, what are the political forms that are required to carry that out? And the human individual is a consequence of a historical process and is the generating point of a further historical process. We exist between, in a sense, those processes of generation. So when you look at humanity, you're looking for expressions of that capability. You're looking for ideas of that type. You're looking for the way in which the human species changed over time. What were the ideas that caused the change? What happens when we don't discover those ideas? What happens when that kind of progress stops? Now, if we look, one of the ways this has been referred to historically in an interesting way is precisely how our idea of the physical space changed. Now, it changes. In other words, we don't live in a flat space. We don't live. If you took everything out, if you thought of it, what's the empty box into which we've been dropped? Because that's most people's view of space. There's the universe, which is this gigantic box, and it's totally empty. And a certain number of objects are plopped into it, and then they kind of bump into each other. And people try to ask themselves, well, what's the geometry of that empty box? Now, here's a problem. This is the way paradoxes arise. How would you possibly find out what the geometry of that empty box is? Now, what happens if you try to stay outside of the box and observe things inside the box? And say, well, wait a minute, I'm not going to touch anything. I'm just going to be this kind of strange observer outside of the box, watching what's going on in the box. Now, ultimately, there's a couple of paradoxes and problems come up. Number one, you might realize that it's almost impossible to measure the activity in the box. It depends on where you are. If you look to the right or to the left, there's an arc, there's a certain change in the vision. There's the shape of your eye. There's the laws that govern the way in which the light comes into your eye. Besides that, you have no way of measuring anything. The only way you can measure something is go inside of the box and measure it. Use some instrument. You're going to move. So anything that you do changes your relationship to what's inside the box, or even worse, you may be acting inside the box. And then you don't know whether or not you've affected the measurements inside the box. Now, of course, there's another problem. you're outside of the box looking in. Let's say, you know, now, but it, then you're not really measuring the space of the universe, right? Because the universe is everything.
Now, if you're outside of the universe, you're outside of everything. That's a very strange place to be.
Yet that, now you may say, come on, you're setting that up. People, but that is precisely the idea of, in order to know the absolute truth of something, you have to get totally outside of it and not be part of it, and then somehow find out something about it. And even as the lunatic information theorist thinks you can sit there and kind of take the data in, the signal. The problem is, the signal's coming into you. You have a physical organism. What is the physical organism doing to the signal? And of course, the same problem comes back up. Does the signal go outside of the universe to reach you? What happens to it when it crosses that barrier from the universe to where you are, which is God knows where? It's outside of everything except where you are. You know, it's often the reality is, contrary to the information theorists, contrary to a great deal of what people thought of as 20th century scientific outlook, the whole point is, the way you come to know reality is you act upon it. You're inside the universe. You're part of the universe. So what you're essentially acting on is how the universe is going to respond to your action, which is always based on a hypothesis about the way you think the universe works. And the universe may answer you and say, good, right, you knew what you were doing. Or the universe may say, a little off. You expected me to do this, and I didn't. But what does that do? That gives you an idea of correcting the way you thought the universe worked. And to the degree that your actions give you some control, some knowable control over the universe, such that it is doing what you expected it to do, and you can make what you expected it to do available for further action, you are beginning to discern what the principles are that guide the relationship between your action and the universe. But since we're part of the universe, that's okay. That's not subjective. That's an actual reaction to what we construct, to some physical process that we construct in the universe. And the progress of those ideas, the fact that as we develop different ideas, we see a certain progress and expansion of our control, or we begin to be able to observe and act upon more and more of the universe. Parts of the universe that never existed for us exist. For example, the subatomic world did not exist. For action, prior to the end of the 19th century. Once that was opened up to us, to generate certain ideas about how to act upon that subatomic universe. And it responded in ways that told us more about the principles that we have. Now, so there is actually an objective truth in this. There's no objective truth in this idea of sitting outside of the universe. That's all subjective. Now, it's precisely this kind of philosophical beginning, this kind of philosophical starting point, that was the debate, in effect, that LaRouche began to wage right after World War II. Because after World War II, partly out of the pessimism of World War I and World War II, out of the idea that human beings cannot progress anymore, came this idea that all we can know is the signal. All we can know is the data that comes in, and however arbitrarily it comes in, all we can do is build up certain statistical models, statistical correlations. And that, there is no such thing as an idea. And by the way, this goes throughout human history. Aristotle's attack on Plato, these are things, you know, I've just met. Aristotle's attack on Plato was that there's no such thing as a universal idea. All you have is experience, and you might generalize that experience as a statistical generalization. But the human mind never really generates a principle, a hypothesis. As Newton says, I don't make hypotheses. I just correlate figures. Or alternately, I have a mathematical formula, and I apply it, and I try to make the universe conform to my mathematical formula. If it doesn't conform, I reject the outcome. Yeah, this is the essence of modern economics, monetary theory. It's all based on the idea that we can never know how the economy works. We can never know how the physical universe works. All we can do is be guided. In fact, what does modern economic theory tell you to do? In the guise, right? What is the idea of deregulation, privatization, free trade? What's the underlying assumptions? Human beings are incapable of knowing how the universe works. In fact, when they think they do, they mess it up. You know, when you try to organize society to create infrastructure, when you try to improve living standards, when you try to take care of people in their old age, you're violating, you think you know how things work, and you're messing everything up. What you should do as a human being is stop this business that you can think. I mean, if you want to feel like you can think, that's okay. Okay? But let's not muck up the world. What you have to do is simply respond to your pleasures, avoid pain, and let the market determine what the economy does. Let the forces of the market, don't try to interfere with an idea that you communicate to other human beings. The explicit principle is that human beings are better off when they think of themselves as animals. And they shouldn't mess it around. If you want to do something in the art world, go ahead. That's the world of feeling. You want to come up with an expression of what you feel, that's okay. That's the art world. That's the world of aesthetics. That's completely separate from economics, because in economics we keep everything human out. And then everything flows from that. And there's something interesting about modern economic theory in the sense that it claims that it's democratic. It's a big word these days, democratic, free. You can do whatever you want, except think. Because if you think, you might try to impose an idea on the economy, and that violates the rules of the economy. That we know. I mean, the paradoxes in this are over and over again. Because, of course, you can ask the question, how do you know that? They're asserting that they know something about the way the world works. But you just said you can't know anything. If you can't know anything, you really don't know that I'm wrong. But the essence of this is to take the idea of the human mind out. And so it becomes relatively easy to find ways that are not what we've done historically. Historically, yes, there are racial differences. And you say, well, this group of people are chosen to be inferior. You can be the slaves. You can be the servants. Or, you know, historically it's been ethnic differences. But what do we have today? No, we're all animals. Some of us just come out on top. Therefore, I'm not doing this based on race, ethnic preference. It's just that I know that since you have, the market has determined that you're inferior to me. So it's wonderfully democratic. Okay? This is why you get this phenomenon. Some of these people in some minority communities who get sold the idea
Don't you want to have a meritocracy just like the white people do? If you make it on your own, don't you want to be recognized as superior? You've made it. You're better than the rest of the people from your ethnic or racial background. You don't want to be dragged down to what they are. And this stuff, in a small way, works. And all it needs to do is work in a small way sometimes. If people are foolish about it. If they don't know what it is to be human. Now, in the course of looking at fighting this kind of epistemological battle, beginning in the 1946, 47, 48 period, in particular from 1948 to 52, what LaRouche was doing at that point was polemicizing philosophically against this idea of information theory, game theory economics. People like Oscar Morgenstern and Johann von Neumann and so on and so forth. People who, in the halls of academia, some of you may have heard of, some not, but these are the big names in modern economic theory. This is exactly what Lin was fighting against. And in the course of doing this, he began to develop a concept of what an economy looks like in physical terms. And what an economy is in physical terms is a sequence of developments that change the internal geometry, so to speak, the internal ordering, and even, you might say, the pricing or the evaluation in the economy as we move from one set of relations based on one technological base, scientific base, to another. That we discover scientific principles that allow us to create new resources. And in the course of doing that, we make human labor more productive. Not just efficient. I hate that word efficient, because efficient people think means easy. We're not talking easy. Okay? I mean, a good example of the problem with efficiency, with this idea of easy as being productive. A perfect example of this. Back to my favorite whipping thing, you know, computers, right? Because the easiest way to do things is to go to the computer. It's efficient. I can just push a couple buttons and I watch the screen roll down. And maybe I even can print it off. Compare that to the amount of hard work it takes to actually work through a discovery. Instead of going to the computer and, you know, you hit Riemann and it prints out some things from Riemann and it says Riemann did this and Riemann did that. And you say, okay, I know what Riemann, and now I know Riemann. I got all the answers, I got all the equations in front of me. Now compare that to actually working through some element of what these guys discovered. A guy like Riemann. Now, when you're finished doing that, your power as a productive, creative human being has expanded. It hasn't expanded when you come off that computer. Therefore, what's easier may be far less productive. Or take the example of off-the-shelf technology, in any case. Often enough, somebody will say, well, the cheapest way to do something, we want to build a new airplane, is let's take what we've got off the shelf, maybe the most advanced stuff, and use that. That's cheaper and easier. It's there. It hasn't been used. How much effort does it take to run a crash program, a crash scientific program, where you're off in areas where you don't even know if you're going to find out what you want to find out? But if you accomplish that, you've improved the productive capabilities, the cognitive powers of virtually the entirety of society. A good example of this is the space program. The typical case, people say, look, it's easier to send a robotic kind of thing out there. Why do we even need a space program? It's a crazy adventure. It's massively expensive. Wouldn't it be easier to just take care of the problems here on the planet? And wouldn't that be better? Well, of course, in truth, we've never taken care of the problems on the planet without challenging ourselves
to the greatest frontiers of human experience and human knowledge. I mean, the same thing was true of naval exploration. We learned more about the universe that gave us greater power over the universe by doing those kinds of things than supposedly coming up with some welfare plan in and of itself. Let's give people, you know, let's try to help people on the planet. What did we do with the space program? We created a situation where we needed more scientists and engineers. We needed so many scientists and engineers, we had to overcome our prejudice. Because we found that we needed to have minorities become scientists and engineers. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with doing that. You know, people might say, well, I know I want to change their hearts, their insides. That'll come. But you're always sometimes you're dealing with people, they've already been here 30, 40, 50 years. There's a lot of thick prejudice to get through. When they find that they need you, they often like you more than they think. Okay? They find reasons to like you, you know? That kind of thing. So you create, you don't do things the easier way. It's that's why when I hear this word efficiency, I know what people mean. It's more efficient. Isn't it more efficient to do that than to do this? You know, we often see this in the organizing. You say, well, wouldn't it be more efficient if I didn't have to go out and organize somebody, if I could find some way to do it without talking to them? Because, you know, talking to them is very frustrating. But if we just had the right sign, the right advertising gimmick, the right form, they would just do it on their own. Couldn't we get on television more? You know, forget it. I mean, you know. In fact, it's by doing the work that you increase your productive capabilities. Now, the history of the human species is the solution to the kinds of problems that people come up with. Like, what's the relationship between a universal principle and a particular instance? Or how do you combine the question of society, the needs of society, and the needs of the individual? Isn't there always a tension between the two? Well, there may be tensions, but in principle, there is not a tension. There may be a fight to gain knowledge of this, but there's not a tension. There's not some kind of ontological paradox. These two things can't exist together. Because the way in which human society has existed is we don't exist in one simple form. We require transition. We require progress. We require transformation. We have to find new scientific discoveries. We have to implement new technologies. We have to then educate the population to the level of technology or scientific knowledge required. Therefore, we have to get a transformation in the human individual. We have to improve the living conditions, the learning environment. Because every new idea has to be communicated to the rest of society in order to be implemented in some degree of fullness, if that society is going to be able to generate further ideas, further new ideas down the road. See, one of the great problems that we have now is, to a certain extent, when we're dealing with an oligarchy, they recognize that they need to know how to use these technologies. Therefore, they'll educate the population to use that technology, at least some section of the population, some set of engineers, even if it's just in weaponry. You know, part of one way to think about it is they need a technology to keep up with their competitors. They need weaponry. They need scientists and engineers to handle that. Now, the problem that they face, as they faced after World War II, is how do you get a bunch of people who can handle the technology for you, but they don't represent a threat in terms of new ideas and new technologies that overturns your control of the system? So what you have to do is train them in such a way that they learn a certain amount, but they can't generate a new idea. They don't know how ideas are generated. That's why the issue is not training people in a given technology. The issue is, how do you create in the individual, which is the uniqueness of the individual, their own ability to generate new qualities of ideas. Now, the reason I'm going into this as a preliminary excursion, you know, into looking at this question of contour and remod, is because, frankly, it's the best way to get the idea. Not that you don't have to get the details and so on and so forth. But this is the idea. It is what Contour and Riemann were looking at. It is what Lynn was looking at. It's why he went to Riemann and then to Contour to develop his idea of physical economy. Because he wanted an image of physics which was coherent with how the human and physical economy and the human mind develops. Because the development of the human mind is our greatest clue to how the way the physical universe functions. We function by developing ideas, and those ideas are appropriate, demonstrated to be appropriate to action in the universe, and that tells us what the universe is like, not the other way around. Now, I'm going to give you a couple of quotes from Riemann to get a sense of this, and then I'm going to go over a couple of quick things on an introduction to contour, but which will certain number of paradoxes of the infinite. But there's a deeper level I want to get to the next time on, you know, this relationship between the continuous. You can think of the domain of the totality of society and the discrete phenomena, or what Riemann calls. Riemann talks about two different kinds of manifolds, discrete and continuous. Now, the whole point is, ultimately, these are not two different manifolds. But there's a relationship between the two that can only occur if we can think in terms of folds, developing manifolds with some principle of development. And that's what forces you in the direction of Riemann's conception of geometry as somewhat viewed, and I have to be a little caught. We'll talk. We'll give you also some of the problems. The contour runs into problems. Contour is a problematic personality in certain respects. Okay, there's a certain ambiguity in the way he approaches things, and there's a better side, and there's a problem. But in order to see what the problem is, and part of the problem is the way he deals with this idea of a continuum, ultimately. Of a continuous sequence of causality, of relationships. An unbreakable sequence of development. Now let me just read you this, because I think this is somewhat, I'll read you two things. This is from the hypotheses that lie at the foundation of geometry. And, you know, there's a lot of other stuff we're looking at, but this is sort of the fundamental philosophical or epistemological outlook. And it was a little surprising to me to reread it again. I always forget things, but he says here, it is well known that geometry presupposes not only the concept of space, but also the first fundamental notions for constructions in space as given in advance. It gives only nominal definitions for them, while the essential means of determining them appear in the form of axioms. The relation of these presuppositions is left in the dark. One sees neither whether and in how far their connection is necessary, nor a priori whether it is possible. In other words, from Riemann's standpoint, we have geometry based on certain axioms, but we really know nothing about where this all comes from, at least as it's developed thus far. And he says, from Euclid to Legendre, to name the most renowned of modern writers on geometry, this darkness has been lifted neither by the mathematicians nor by the philosophers who have labored upon it. And I presume that includes Euclid and Legendre. Accordingly, I have proposed to myself at first the problem of constructing the concept of a multiply extended magnitude out of general notions of quantity. From this it will result that a multiply extended magnitude is susceptible of various metric relations, and that space accordingly constitutes only a particular case of a triply extended magnitude. So his idea is that there's a much more general, universal concept of a manifold. That is a manifold of relations. A set of relations that are both continuous but have a discrete manifestation. A necessary sequel of this is that the propositions of geometry are not derivable from general concepts of quantity, but these properties by which space is distinguished from other conceivable triply extended magnitudes can be gathered only from experience. Now, I'm not going to go... He talks about Euclid. These facts are, like all facts, not necessary, but of a merely empirical certainty. They are hypotheses. That's what he means. One may therefore inquire into their probability, which is truly very great within the bounds of observation, and thereafter decide concerning the admissibility of protracting them, and so on. Now, the concept of an n-extended manifold. While I now attempt in the first place to solve the first of these problems, the development of the concept of manifolds multiply extended, I think myself the more entitled to ask considerate judgment, inasmuch as I have had little practice in such matters of a philosophical nature, where the difficulty lies more in the concepts than in the construction. And because I have not been able to make use of any preliminary studies whatever, aside from some very brief hints which Privy Councillor Gauss has given on the subject in his second essay on biquadratic residues in his Jubilee booklet, and some philosophical investigations of Herbart. Now, in other words, Riemann thought a great deal of what he was doing, as I quoted that thing from Cantor, as the philosophical development of concepts first, which are going to be applied to his general development of the idea of geometry, or what geometry really is. And later on, I don't want to read too much because it gets a little different, but he says at the end a couple of these famous quotes where he says, in order to apply geometry in the large to the small, to know that it extends, you have to know what he calls the colligating forces, or later he says you have to move into the area of physics. And what you're dealing with in the geometry is the way in which the universe generates relationships amongst changing geometries. That's why we call it recently, Kästner calls it anti-Euclidean. Because the essence of Euclidean is not straightness. The essence of Euclidean is axiomatic. Euclidean geometry is axiomatic. It begins with a set of assumptions and axioms about how things act in space or how you measure the space. Now, frankly, what most people call non-Euclidean is simply a different axiomatic system. You change an axiom. That's the famous story. Now, there's a certain point in it, but you change the parallel postulate, and you get a different surface. You move from a flat surface to a spherical surface. You move from a spherical surface to a saddle-shaped surface. What do? You change one axiom to do that. You can change other axioms. A spherical surface is a surface that has no parallel lines. All lines, if extended far enough, meet. A spherical surface, a saddleback, some people call it, is a surface in which an infinite number of lines might be drawn through a point that don't meet another line. You change an axiom. Riemann's point, Kästner's point, is, no, I'm looking at something that's different, a totally different view of geometry, a non-axiomatic geometry. A geometry which is really looking at the way in which surfaces change under physical action and how that, what the relationship is of their change. You're looking at surfaces, how a surface changes as a physical action occurs within it, and then what the relationship is as these surfaces change. That's Riemannian geometry. Now you begin to think that he's looking at how you move from one surface to another. But these are connected surfaces. They're not separated. It's not like you're jumping from one surface to another magically. There's some way in which you're moving from one surface to another.
Isn't that what Gauss does?
What's he doing with Gauss? Well, Gauss just doesn't go as far along this road. I mean, he's in this direction. But Riemann states it as a principle. Gauss simply says that he's also discovered other geometries. Okay? And Gauss doesn't really work on this question of a sequence of surfaces. He doesn't develop this idea of a sequence of surfaces. He's dealing with the intrinsic metric of surfaces of different measure. But Riemann wants to look at how you actually move from one surface to another. Okay? Now, there's a reason why Lin says, look at contour. You have to look at this through the eyes of contour. Because there's a critical element to the what an idea is that contour develops in this idea of the transfinite. Now, in part, and I'm not going to go through this side of it, because contour comes out of two things. Contour comes partly out of this Riemannian analysis of functional relations in space. He also partly, in number theory, he also partly comes out of a certain approach to number theory, which we may get a chance to look at some point. But I wanted just to develop one point tonight, just giving people a certain sense of what it is that contour begins to introduce. Now, some of it, because what contour looks at, and this comes up in Riemann's geometry. These are differential geometries. You're looking at the measurement of change in the small. How do these changes occur? What are the differences in the measurements of the surface? You're going from one surface to the other. You're going through a process of change where, in some sense, the relationships remain the same. And then at some unique point, the entire internal geometry of the surface changes. You have to, the mapping from one surface to the other changes. Now, all of these ideas, all of these conceptions of the geometry, of the measurement of the geometry, involves certain concepts of the infinite. The same thing in the calculus. It already comes up in the calculus. At this point, in many ways, the concept of the infinite exists in mathematics in a way that it doesn't when you're simply dealing with numbers. You know, in other words, when you're dealing with 1, 2, 3, 4, it's true you can extend that infinitely. Okay? You can go on and on. But any number that you deal with is a finite number. The only way that the idea of the infinite comes in is you can keep going if you want to. But you're always dealing with finite numbers. Now, in a funny way, the same thing is true Euclidean geometry, straight line geometry. Because it's true that the line can be extended forever. And so you have some rather impoverished idea of the infinite. In fact, contour calls it a bad infinite or an unactual infinite. And many people call it that. Because even though you say, well, I could go on forever and ever, any line that you deal with is finite. The problem really becomes serious, it's more interesting in mathematics. It comes up already, in some sense, with the idea of the square root of 2. Because the square root of 2 requires a representation as a number that is infinite, if you just write the number out. In other words, it's a non-repeating decimal. So you never know what that number is, except as an infinitely written number. There's an infinite process to get it, but you can construct that number in a finite number of steps. So even though it has an infinite characteristic, you can construct the square root of 2 relatively simply. You just take a unit line, two sides, the two legs of the unit line, and you know you've got the square root of 2, and that's a finite representation of it.
That actually turns out to be a little important a little bit later on.
It's only when you begin to deal with the calculus and differential geometry that this idea of an infinite process is essential to the concept of number.
Or another example of it is where we get it is in transcendental numbers. Right? There are certain kinds of numbers which, on the one hand, can't be written. You have to write them as an infinite decimal, but also you can't construct them in a finite number of steps. Like the number pi, it turns out, is not constructible. You can construct the circle and the diameter, but you can't construct the ratio between them. It's an infinite construction process. You get closer and closer.
Isn't Kepler bring this up?
Yeah, Kepler brings it up. That's right. And he brings it up as a problem because he says, in order for me to measure areas under non-constant curvature, my mathematics is inadequate. I need something that really begins to allow me to deal with infinite processes. And that's the problem he leaves for Leibniz and so on. So yeah, that's exactly what happens.
But what's interesting is now this idea of an infinite has to be addressed as an actual requirement in understanding the nature of what mathematics is dealing with. Not the math itself. What's the nature of surfaces? What's the nature of physical actions that require a representation that requires to bring into the representation certain infinite processes? Our mathematics has now changed. Really what you get, and we can come back to this because I want to get to a couple quick points and not go too late, but really what you get in this idea is
what's the best way to put it? Let me come back to that point.
What you get is this idea that the concept of number itself is changing. And what happens when you change? You subsume all the other numbers in the new definition of number. Now you have whole numbers, and you have fractions, which you can see as ratios of whole numbers. But now you got certain kinds of things like the square root of 2, irrationals, which cannot be expressed as whole number relations, except as a constructive process. So you begin to have to change your idea. If you are going to include the square root of 2 among numbers, then you have to change what you think of numbers. Now you can change it, partly express it as constructions, but then when you get to the idea of a transcendental number, a number that it requires an infinite process to represent it, how do you include that kind of number in whole numbers, in fractions? Well, you change your idea of fractions and whole numbers. They become a special case of the process by which you generate pi and such transcendentals. In fact, that's what you do. You take rotational action and you demonstrate that you can produce discrete countable numbers out of rotational action. It's rotational action that generates transcendentals, e, pi, and so on, and things like that. Now you take those kinds of rotational actions and you generate fractions and whole numbers. And you get a whole new representation of it. You get the complex domain by certain kinds of rotational actions applied to rotational actions, or extensions of rotational actions, spiral action, and you now recognize you have to bring in the complex domain to deal with some certain concept of transcendental numbers like E. Okay, E is a certain you can look at it in two different ways. It's a relationship between the side, the ray up of the spiral and the length of the spiral, but it's a spiral action. Or you can look at it as the exponential function whose subtangent is always 1. And that gives you the two exponential curves which characterize the number, which is characterized, it's e to the x. Okay, these are things we can look at. We have pedagogicals on. Okay, now it turns out that this number is related to complex numbers. So now all of a sudden we've taken the complex domain, which subsumes transcendental numbers, and so we're going through a process whereby as we discover a new physical process, we generate a new concept of number, and we change our previous concept of number. Now, one of the reasons to go through this is this mysterious thing that always gets people a little freaked out when you look at the question of economic value. Price. What's a price? You don't get a price by money. A good example of this is, you know, what's the value, this case that people take, what's the value of a plumber or a doctor, but take the case of the plumber, who maybe today does something, and then a year from now does exactly the same thing. But the value of that plumber's activity has increased without him changing anything that he does. How does that work? Well, if the productive capability of the society as a whole has improved, we've introduced new technology, denser forms of energy. If the labor force is operating at a higher level, then the value of his doing the plumbing has increased even though he's done nothing different. That's the same thing we're talking about in terms of the development of this concept of number. Now, Cantor addresses himself to kind of two kinds of questions. One are certain kinds of paradoxes of the infinite that were known, and they pose certain questions to him. The other is, what kind of process of the infinite are we using in mathematics? What concept of the limit, of how you approach a limit in calculus, how you construct some of these numbers that are constructible only by infinite processes. Now, the kind of thing, we can start with the simple kind of fun side of it, and that's probably all we're going to get to. But we will get to one point which should get you, if you play around with it, you'll get an idea what I mean by that one of the virtues of what Cantor does is he develops the idea that the moment of change, the principle itself, is always something that is outside as an existent. It's outside of what it generates. That the principle is outside of what it generates. And we were talking about this yesterday with Jonathan in terms of supersonic flight, that the key point is not to go nuts over exactly how the shock wave forms on the plane's wing, but to realize that we're looking for a principle that allows you to make the transition from subsonic to supersonic airflow, that there's a change in the way these things work, and there's a principle that binds both of them. Now, let's look at a certain kind of an example. First of all, start with these simple little paradoxes which make you figure some things out. We have the whole numbers. Now, the whole numbers are, in this sense that I said, somewhat impoverished sense, infinite. Except immediately, certain kinds of funny things come up when you deal with an infinite grouping. So if I take any finite group, suppose I take, I don't know, 1 through 1,000,000. Whatever, and we don't want to spend a lot of time writing stuff up. If I say, well, let's take all the even numbers between 1 and 1,000,000. Are they more or less than the numbers from 1 to 1,000,000? If I took 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 up to 1,000,000, are there more of those, the same or less than the numbers between 1 and 1,000,000? And maybe this is such a simple, stupid question. It's obvious, right? There's half as many even numbers.
Yeah.
If I took any finite number and asked that question, no matter how big it was, the even numbers are half the numbers. That's all, that's the definition of even, isn't it? It's every other number. However, when we leap to the infinite, we get something funny. If I say, let's take all of the whole numbers out to infinity, and all of the even numbers out to infinity, which is more? Some of you know the answer, so, but which is more? I mean, in one sense, the mind would say, okay, I extend the process. I think some of you say, well, in fact, when you think about it, even though you may know the answer, it's a little bit hard to grasp. Because I can demonstrate, in one sense, that the number of even numbers between 0 and infinity and the number of whole numbers between 0 and infinity are the same. They're equal. Even though if I stop the process anywhere, there's only half as many even numbers. If I extend the process forever, they're the same number. Now, some people say, well, you should leave out this whole idea of the infinite, because it leads to these kinds of crazy ideas. But look, if you look at it, how do I do it? How can I prove it? You may be clever and say, well, wait a minute. How can you prove it? Because it's infinite. You can't go out there and check it all out. You can't go out and count the number of even numbers forever and say, see, it's the same. But you can prove it. Because I can give you a rule that will show you that for any number that you give me, I can map it onto an even number. One for one, unique. A one-to-one unique mapping. For every whole number, one and only one even number. And for every even number, one and only one whole number. And it's absurdly simple, which is what? If I say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 forever, and then I can say n, I can say, 2n. That's all I need to know. I can say 2n1, 2n2, 2n3, and so on. Because what am I going to get? For 1, I get 2. For 2, I get 4. For 3, I get 6. For 4, I get 8. I'm going to get every even number that there is. And for every whole number, I've got an even number. So they're equivalent. Yeah.
It seems like the idea of an infinite would be like a whole number or even number has an axiomatic system on it. So then that's what creates the non-infinite aspect to it.
Well, I mean, there is an axiomatic quality to it. I wouldn't say it creates. Would you say the non-what?
It makes it non-infinite, because once you put an axiom on it, as far as like a whole number or an even number, then it ceases to be.
Well, these are
because it's bounded. Like,
well, not really. This is unbounded. These are unbounded in that sense. I mean, I can generate these. There's nothing that stops me from generating.
But they're bounded within the axioms that you define them in.
Well, they're bounded by their definition.
Yeah.
But they're not limited. There's a different question here. This is actually unbounded. In a certain sense, the problem here is they're axiomatically unbounded. Because the axiom by which you generate the whole numbers is successor. You know, all I'm doing is I define the following. It's the way induction works. I define the following. Give me the number 1, and I can generate whole numbers forever, because the rule is plus 1, and there's nothing that stops that from going on. There's no boundary condition to it.
Well, I understand that. What I'm saying is there's an axiomatic system that's functioning on top, like as far as like a rule on that, that makes it non-infinite.
Well, it's both infinite and non-infinite. I mean, there's a point at which it's a bad infinite. You never get to it, but you can apply a rule that allows you to keep going. So it has a problem in it. But I wouldn't say that it's unbounded. The quality of it is that it's bounded. Okay? I mean, it's unbounded. Okay? But
there's a point that you have in the sense that it has a limitation in that you can never generate a whole the infinite as a identifiable object in the system. Now, actually, Cantor addresses this to a certain extent. So there is an ambiguity, but I don't think it's as absolute as you're making. In other words, the point is that there's an ambiguity. By the nature of the system, it can go on and on forever, so you have that concept of infinite. But it never gives you a whole infinite. Okay? And that's, I think, part of what you're getting at. Yeah, that's part of why it works this way. That's getting at something. I mean, and Cantor actually addresses this in the way he tries to deal with some later problems.
I don't understand your proof. Could you say that one more time? Why is the proof?
Well, so in other words, I have a rule that applies to every number. I don't need to know the number. It's a perfectly applicable rule. For every whole number, I just take twice that number. And so I have a one-to-one mapping. I'm never going to run out of even numbers. And therefore, when I go to the infinite, all of a sudden they turn out to be equal. Whereas if I stop at any point, I've got more whole numbers than even numbers. Huh?
Yeah, man, it's just kind of silly that you just double it.
Well, there's a rule. It's just a way in which I can map one. It's a mapping rule. Okay? Now, sometimes people think that anything you do in mathematics is a little bit arbitrary, but it really isn't. I mean, it's a perfectly legitimate rule. It's as though for example, if I said, for every person in this room, if it turns out that, let's say I have a group of people in the bigger room, okay, and I want to find out, do I have our relation between the people in this room and the people in that room? Now, I can do this not just by going one. I can say, okay, let me do this. I'm going to start in the right. I'm going to move across to the left until I hit the wall. And I'm going to do the same thing out there. And if every time I hit a person out there, somebody in here says, I've hit a person in here. And when I'm finished, there's not any person left over. Then I've proven that there's a one-to-one mapping from this room to that room. So it's it doesn't make it weird. It might be a strange thing to do. Okay, it's an awfully long process. But see, what are you doing? What happens when I count the people in this room? I'm doing exactly the same thing. I'm making a map from numbers. Let's say I've got numbers up here: 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Right now, what am I doing when I count? I'm saying you're the number one, so I have the relation between the number one and you. I'm going to take the number two. That's Jerry. I'm going to take the number three. I don't know your name. Michelle. Right. Right. Is that right? Oh, God. Number four. So I'm just making a rule that maps numbers onto the people in the room. Mm. Now, if... in this case, when I run out of numbers and there's nobody else left in the room, that's the number of people in the room. If I only had 10 numbers up here, I might do it another way. I might say, well, let me take 10 numbers. That's all I've got. I'm only going to deal up to 10. And I'll give you an example of that. And then I say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And I've run out of numbers, but I've still got people. Well, then I have many people in the room. Up to 10, I have 10 people in the room. Once I get beyond 10, it's just many. It's just more people than I have numbers. I've run out of things. But that's how people... By the way, that is a real process. In some cultures, primitive cultures, or I don't know if they were primitive or wrecked or whatever, but you'll find they'll count a certain number of things, generally around 5. You know, there's a reason. In the perceptual field, you'll find that at a certain glance, the most number of discrete objects people will generally guess at correctly is up to about 5. Beyond that, the visual apparatus will tend to just think of some, you know, or many. So a lot of cultures, the way they count is they count up to 5 or 10, and everything above 5 or 10 is many. Okay? So that's the kind of principle involved in this. It's primitive, that's for sure. But all I'm doing is I'm using it. Now, of course, what's interesting about this is once you kind of get the idea,
ask yourself the following. Well, what about every third number? What if I took every third number?
Same thing.
3n.
If you did 1 in 1 million.
Same thing. In other words, the gap that I can use is as big as I want as long as it's a finite number. I could say, for example, I could make a 10n as a jerk, right?
Mm-hmm.
I could probably do all kinds of weird things I haven't thought of right now. The gap could get bigger and bigger. I could probably do n square n. Okay, so you have a bigger and bigger gap. And I still have exactly the same, a one-to-one mapping from the counting numbers to my other map. In fact, the only time we break down is if I made the gap infinite. Okay? Now, so the infinite caused people a lot of problems. A lot of people did say we shouldn't even think of this idea. We should just rule it out. Okay? One way to do it is we can only deal with things we can construct. But the problem that you realize that comes up in mathematics is there are things that you can construct as physical processes that, if you want to replicate them in a mathematical language, require an infinite number of steps. Now, this led people, of course, Cantor then begins to ask himself the question, since we deal with the infinite in geometry and so on and so forth, is this the only kind of infinite that there is? And if so, well, there's not much to deal with. We're just dealing with this question of using this idea of infinite extension. But are there any other ideas of the infinite? Or any other kinds of infinite? Is there just one kind of infinite? And in some ways, then we can deal with it. What?
I just had a question. I don't know if these two are related at all, but I was thinking of how Cantor says that a infinite line is the same thing as an infinite triangle, sphere.
Yes.
I was kind of thinking of that.
Yes, it's similar. And the proof is somewhat similar. In fact, the proof at one level of lines of different magnitude, are these the same kind of infinite? Is that what you're kind of referring to?
Yeah, well, how he says, like, if you take the triangle...
Yeah. Well, yeah, if you do
infinite.
This, what happens is, if you take a point outside of this, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same thing to the triangle, but I'm doing the simpler case, because that's a little more complicated.
Oh, yeah, the parallel lines.
Yeah. Are two parallel lines of finite magnitude, are they different kinds of infinity? No, because you can map one... if you take a point outside of it, this point above, right, I can do this. And it's going to turn out I can map every point on this line onto the bigger line. All I have to do is, as I draw this point down, the closer it gets, I have a way of mapping every point on the smaller line onto the bigger line. Okay? And that's a more obvious mapping problem than the other ones. I mean, it seems more reasonable. So as I move this thing down, as it gets closer and closer, my ray coming out extends as far as this line has to extend. It just depends on the differences of length. But frankly, even if this was almost infinitely long, if I got right down on top of this thing, I could extend this endpoint about as far out as I wanted to. So yeah, there are other cases the one you're talking about is he maps two dimensions. He shows you that even if you move to another dimension, it doesn't change. Now that gets a little interestingly problematic, but there's a certain way he's looking at it. But yeah, he says if you take a square, and I'm not gonna, you can map it onto a line. Okay, yeah. Now the interesting thing is you do take it out of order. Let me give you the example actually that gives you the idea. Because the first thing he thought is, well, maybe, and we'll end on the next one, because this is the one you have to get, but it's the one that people have the most problem with.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take the phone. Now, the thing that might seem obvious is, let's take something that's really different. Numbers are discrete. That would seem to be the perfect case of what Riemann refers to as the discrete manifold.
Okay? One, two. There's nothing in between. There's one and there's two. And they have a characteristic. Between one and two, between any two whole numbers, there is no other whole number. Okay? You think there is, Aaron?
I don't know. Pythagoreans.
Yeah, but they're not whole numbers. They're fractions, or they're, you know, they're decimals. I'm talking about a whole number, a number that has no parts, or the parts are whole numbers. Two has two parts, one and one. Okay. Now, precisely, if you think you're dealing with fractions, fractions are ratios of whole numbers. Okay, 2 to 7, etc. 3 to 8, you know, whatever your unique description is. Okay, now that seems to have a different principle to it. Because what's the character of fractions? They appear to be continuous. Between any two fractions, there's another fraction. There's an infinite number of fractions. Right? If between a half and a quarter, there's an infinite number of fractions. I mean, they get ridiculous, but, you know, what do you have? You know, 3/8, 7/16, you can keep going that way. Okay, and you can get denser and denser, but you don't run out of fractions. So, the question that comes up is, are the fractions somehow a different infinite, a larger infinite? Now, Cantor more rigorously defines some of these questions, but, you know, in terms of what he means by equal and so forth, but you get an idea. Equal is a one-to-one mapping. It's what he calls equivalence. It's very interesting. What he says is, numbers which can be mapped one to one onto each other, or not numbers, I'll give you manifolds that can be mapped one to one uniquely onto each other, have the same power, or what he calls mechtic type power. He doesn't say they're simply equivalent, they have the same power. In other words, in some ways, there's the same things you can do with them. Hmm. Now, let's look at the fractions, because you would think, well, all right, 1, 2, 3, between any two numbers, there's an infinite number of fractions, but there's no, and there's a different kind of a sense of their consistency, so to speak. One is discrete, the other has a certain continuous quality to it. However, and this is actually, at this point, Cantor thought maybe there is only one kind of infinite. Okay, because what he found is he could find a way to map the whole numbers one to one onto the rational numbers. But one interesting feature is he had to find a way to make them discrete. He had to find a way to take them out of their normal order and put them into a discrete order. So what he did was, he said, well, let's do the following. Actually, it's mind-bogglingly simple. He said, let's just list the fractions in some... Now, this isn't exactly the most rigorous way to do it, but he said, let's just list the fractions in the following way. Now, what's interesting about this, look what I've done. I've taken the fractions. Now, there's one problem with this, but you can deal with it fairly simply. Okay. Does anybody know what the one problem is?
You have one appearing a bunch of times.
Huh?
You've got one appearing a bunch of times?
Or? Yeah. Well, there's a redundancy in it, because fractions can be, numbers can be represented in more than one way by the same fraction.
Yeah.
1/1 and 2/2 are the same. But the problem, actually, it's not that big a problem, because all it means is I've got more fractions here than I need. Some of them represent the same number. Now, one, if you want to be completely rigorous, you can drop out the repetitions. Okay? But for what I'm going to do, it doesn't represent much of a problem, because I have all the fractions up here, in principle, by the rule that I'm setting them out. I can list every fraction. And if I got a few of them more than once, it's not going to make it easier to count them. Okay? But what about, if you notice what I've done, is very, because I can prove that they're all here, because look what I've done. I've taken every fraction with one in the numerator, and I've listed it this way. I've cut, because this is now, I've just done, the denominators are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and I can just go 1, and I've got 1 over every number. So I get every number with 1 in the numerator. I've got every number with 2 in the numerator. I've got every number with 3 in the numerator. I've got every number with 4 in the numerator. And since this list can go on and on and on, I've got every numerator and every denominator in every combination. But notice what I've done. I've made it discrete. I separated out just the way the counting numbers are separated out. So I've got n rows of n numbers. Now guess what? N times n. It's countable, right? And I can show you, I can just do it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I just go up and down the diagonals.
You're just counting those as a...
Like a snake, a diagonal. Right. And since I'm never going to run out of counting numbers, I can count all the way down, all the way up, and all the way across. So you can count the fractions with the counting numbers. Check it out, as they say.
So what do you mean by discrete?
Well, there's nothing in between these two. Everything that's in between these two is listed somewhere else. I've made them completely separated. There's no fraction in between the two fractions. Not the way it's put down here.
Would you say that the difference between 1 and 2 is 7?
Where? Between, what do you mean here?
Yeah.
What do you mean 7?
Like you say, like 1/4?
Well, I can say there's a difference, but the way they're listed, in other words, I've taken all the fractions between 1 and 1/2, and I've listed them somewhere else, in a discrete, some other discrete place, some place where it's separated. Okay? So the listing is a discrete listing. Okay? I found a way to list them discreetly. Now, if you took the number 1 and 1/2, I could generate fractions, but those fractions already exist somewhere else on this list. So they'd be redundant if I put them between these two numbers. Okay? So now, all of a sudden, the fractions, as objects, so to speak, are countable. Well, that tells you something, because fractions are relationships between whole numbers. They're ratios. They're really whole numbers in special kinds of relationships. Now, at this point, Cantor actually thought maybe there is just one kind of infinite. Until, and now here, the, until some, he, you know, now he actually got this through a different process, which is interesting, because it really, the process that came up, which I'll just describe, is when he was dealing with what we call the real numbers, right, the numbers that include square roots, but also transcendentals. That is, numbers that require an infinite non-repeating decimal to list them, to write them out. But also can only be constructed by an infinite process. Like, for example, you take the track tricks, you know, or you take what happens when you pull a truck, you turn a truck, and you look at the curve that a truck make, the rear wheels of the truck make. That's what they call a track tricks. It's a constantly changing curve. Hmm. And if you try to represent that by any ruler and compass or any simple mechanical procedure, you have to use an infinite sequence of tangents to get that. Now that's, you know, that's what gets you a transcendental. Now, so why that's important is because those kinds of numbers exist, and because you can, after a while, prove there's an infinite number of them. Okay, you have to write real numbers as infinite non-repeating decimals. There's no other way to write them. Okay? Now, wait. So then Contra says, well, let's see. Are the real numbers countable? And he asks himself, he says, well, let's assume. Now, this is, let's assume that they are countable. Let's assume that for every whole number, there's one and only one real number. Right. Infinite non-repeating, like pi, 3.14, you know.
Is it what you call real numbers? Is that,
yeah. All right.
Is it counting numbers?
Huh?
By real numbers, what do you mean?
No, real numbers is what I mean, things like pi, square root of 2. And actually, you ultimately, when you write out numbers as real numbers, you even write something like the number 1 as an infinite decimal, 0.999999. Because you're making one the same kind of number as the other, as the unique kinds of real numbers that can only be written that way. Okay? So now you're going to write every number as a infinite decimal, not an infinite non-repeating decimal, but an infinite decimal which will include non-repeating decimals. Okay? See, the fact that there are numbers that can only be written as infinite non-repeating decimals means that to incorporate them all in the same list, you're going to take every number and write it as an infinite decimal, 0.33333 1/3, okay, and so on and so forth. They repeat; those repeat. But for example, the square root of 2 doesn't repeat, and more importantly, pi doesn't repeat, and it's not constructible in a finite number of steps. So, since there are such numbers that cannot even be constructed in a finite number of steps, you need to write the real numbers as infinite decimals to have them all be comparable. All right.
But so you said they which one of the ones that do repeat and don't repeat, would which one of those would be a bad infinite?
No, in this case, since they're all constructible, none of them are bad infinites.
Even when they're written.
Yeah. You're just writing them that way because that's the way to sort of write them down as numbers. Okay? But the square root of 2 is a number. And actually, even the transcendentals. I mean, the transcendental we know exists. That ratio exists. The only way you can write it down as a number is as an infinite non-repeating decimal. But that's something you prove about its nature. So it's not a bad infinite. You've proven that what this ratio is expressible as an infinite non-repeating decimal. That's the best way I can explain it for right now. Okay, that may not answer the whole thing.
Can I ask another question?
What?
Well, because I have trouble with that. To me, it would seem more like there's one infinite and there's different relationships to that.
Well, we're talking about a certain question, which is the mappability of them one to one another. Mm-hmm. So you might want to conceptualize in different ways, but I'm going to show you that there's a sharp distinction that you have to take into account in this ultimate unity that you're talking about. So it's not enough to just say I think it's a unity. Well, but I'm saying you can think of it that way. But I'm showing you that even in that thought, there's a difference that you have to take into account.
Well, just because you said that Contra was saying that it might be just.
Well, he was saying that if he couldn't he thought that if the fractions were countable, maybe there wasn't anything else. Maybe there was nothing he was going to find that couldn't be mapped onto the real number, to the whole numbers. But he changed his mind because he found out there was an infinity with a difference. Okay? All right? So, now, because the way he does this, it's going to get worse. Okay? And at a certain point, everybody thinks, anyway, so he says, well, I don't know what the mapping is, but let's assume. Let's make the assumption, okay, if there were a list, and this is where it's good to think in the subjunctive. Let's assume that there is such a list. I don't need to know what it is. I'm going to make the assumption now that for every whole number, integer, there's one and only one unique real number associated with it. That somebody's generated it. The list exists, And I assume it exists. Okay? Now, he says, well, I can give you what this list must look like. Because whatever that number is, it looks like something. It has a first decimal. A second decimal, a third decimal, a fourth decimal, right? And so on. Now, in other words, it has some number that is infinite when you write it down. It's an infinite expression. And it's got a number in the first place, a number in the second place, a number in the third place, whatever it is. I'm just assuming this list exists. Let there be such a list. Yeah, it's a good way to learn why the subjunctive is so important. Okay? You can't even think. If you don't think subjunctively, what happens is people say, well, what is the list? That's the non-subjunctive. That's the indicative. Okay? I'm not saying I know what the list is. I'm saying I'm going to assume as a hypothesis that there is such a list. And actually, even though I don't know anything about what the list looks like, I can tell you something about its characteristics. So I have this, but now what do I know I'm dealing with? I'm dealing with this number, but it's also I'm going to make a unique. I'm going to identify it as being associated with the number one. So I'm going to say, give it the index one. It's the first row. So I have a number A1, A2, A3, A4, A5. And I'm going to identify it as associated with this number 1 by saying it's the first row. So it's the first number in the first row, the second number in the first row, the third number in the first row. I'm going to give it an index so I know exactly where these A's are. Okay? And each one is going to be different. And this goes on. In the second place, I have the first number in the second row, the second number in the second row, the second number in the third row, the third number in the second row, the fourth number in the second row, the fifth number in the second row. Well, I should do one more. And I'm going to do the third row, the first number in the third row, the second number in the third row, the third number in the third row, the fourth number in the third row, the fifth number in the third row, the sixth number in the third row. Okay? And so on. I'm not going to... It's getting late, sorry. A14, A24, A34.
The whole list, Phil.
A74, A54, A64. Okay, and then we have A15, A25, A35, A45, and so on, right? And people get the idea. Now I'm assuming that I have this list. And this list is the infinite numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And for every one of these, I've got one, and this list is complete. This is it. This is the list we have. It's finished. It's done. It's complete. I've got it all. I've got a one-to-one correspondence. They're the same size. Except some whiz kid, some genius comes along. Uh-oh. Says, wait a minute. And this actually came from a process that Cantor was involved in trying to generate all the real numbers and show that they were of a certain kind, that they were all limit points. Every real number is a limit point. He actually showed that you can construct every number on the number line as the limit of an infinite sequence. Except in doing that, he came up with this problem. Now, suppose I did the following. Suppose I took A and N. Let's suppose I took every A that was on the diagonal. It was the fifth position in the fifth row, the fifth column, the fourth row, the fourth column. So I have a way of picking a position on every number, a unique position. And I'm going to make a simple, silly rule. I'm going to say, if ANN equals 5, change it to 6. Okay? And if ANN is not equal to 5, change it to 5. Okay?
Phil, just one thing. When you said that the what he's trying to see is all real numbers are countable?
Yeah.
Which would mean if you can count how many there are.
Yeah.
Okay.
If I can make them a one-to-one correspondence with the counting numbers. Now look at what's going to happen. I'm going to create a number here. Okay? A new number. It's going to be a real number. A decimal. Because since it's ANN, I'm picking it off the whole list all at one time. That number, I'm going to argue, cannot be on this list.
Is that a dot in front of that thing?
Which one?
I was just wondering if you had a dot in front of all those numbers.
Where?
I think you meant decimal. No, the first one in the first row.
Oh, yeah, that's, I don't know. That's just the decimal, yeah.
Okay, decimal number.
Okay.
You can do the last thing again, Phil? All the same numbers?
I'm gonna create a number off this list that can't be on this list by the way it's constructed. Okay, how do I know that? Well, suppose I ask, is this new number, ANN, which I construct, which I say, I go along the diagonal, and I've got a rule for this number. If the diagonal number is 5, I change it to 6. If it's not 5, I change it to 5. Okay, now ask yourself the question, can that number be anywhere on this list? Is it the same one as the number 1? No, because it's a different number in the first position. Because if this number is 5, my number is 6. And if this number is not 5, my number is 5. So my number is different than the one that's listed next to the number 1. Could it be the second number? Because it's different in the second position.
The number you're trying to create, you will be taking it with the diagonal? Okay. Not from any of the rows.
No, I created it along the diagonal. My number is the number that's created out of ANN by this process. Mm-hmm. And ANN is the diagonal.
Okay.
So it can't be anywhere on this list, because any number on this list is different than my number at the position ANN. And if somebody got clever and said, wait a minute, all I have to do is add your number to the list. And I just add one more counting number, right? Because counting numbers are infinite. Except I just generated a new number. Now I have a new number. So no, and no matter how many times you do it, every time you do it, I generate a new number.
But you said it again.
Well, suppose I create this number. It's not on this list. Now suppose somebody says, well, it's only one number. So let me add it to the list somewhere. So now it's on the list, but in putting it on the list, I just generated a new number.
Hey, so what you're saying is that all numbers are infinite?
No, not all numbers. What I'm saying is something different. It has nothing to do with a specific number. What I'm saying is that once I generate this idea of a real number, which is required, in a sense, to fill all the positions on the real number line, then I've got something that's not countable.
Is it once you generate a real number, you've got something that's not countable?
Yeah. I just showed you, you can't count it, because no matter how long you make this list, here's the trick. I've now created a situation, it's not a trick, where every time you try to count this, every time you do this, you generate a new number. See, what I've done is I've thrown a principle in here that generates a number outside of your list.
Okay.
And no matter what you do to your list, it's a little bit like Mercury. No matter what you do to your list, when you do it, you create a new number for me. It's a little bit of a catch-22. Just when you think you're going to say, all right, it's stupid, it's only one number. One number is one more counting number. So it's not the problem that I've generated one number. That's true, it's only one number. Whatever number I generate up here can be counted. It's not that. It's the fact that I've created a process for generating a number. It's a real number off of your list. And maybe that tells you something about a unique quality of the real numbers as compared to the counting numbers. There's something that allows you to generate a number.
Hey, Phil. There's a reason when you listed it, why you couldn't have done that on the other.
Try it. That list you can't jigger around with. I can't create a new number. That list, by definition, the fractions, has every fraction on it. This one doesn't, because I can generate a number out of it. I couldn't. How can I generate a number out of the fractions? Work on it.
Yeah.
Partly it has to do with the fact that it's the transcendental numbers have to be written infinitely. And that means that this list is infinite in all directions. So I have a kind of a power. It's like moving into another direction here, into a new dimension of this type, gives me a new power. So this whole question of dimension is kind of funny. It's not when you think of dimension as just linear extension, it doesn't give you a power. It's some kind of action between two dimensions that gives you a power. Now I got something I never. Now I have a new infinite number that's not comparable to my previous infinite numbers. I have a process of generation. Now we have something interesting to look at in terms of infinite numbers. And now he has a sense of saying, well, these are not... Here's an interesting thing. You have the unbounded counting numbers, but they're less than the real numbers between 0 and 1. So you have a bounded infinite that's greater than what seems to be an unbounded infinite.
There's more counting numbers than there are real numbers?
No, there's more real numbers than there are counting numbers. Because there's a generative principle here that's different.
What numbers are these? 9 to the 35th on the bottom?
What?
What numbers?
No, are there any numbers?
A.
Oh, A. I'm sorry. My handwriting is terrible. I'm sorry.
I'm not really clear on what you mean by real numbers. And like whole numbers, transcendental.
Real numbers are like decimals, non-repeating decimals, like 3.145, you know. Now, here's an interesting thing to ponder, which was, you know, when Cantor did this, in a certain sense, we'll just... Because now he gets up... Now what Cantor does is he begins to look at... He thinks of numbers, these aggregates of numbers, and I'll give you one little quote I want to give you. As... completed infinites, that we're going to deal with each kind of infinite as a number itself. Okay? And now you mean to see what Lin used in Cantor when he looked back at Riemann. Because it's not just a relationship of surfaces, but you're going to look at, and there's a lot more to discuss with, but you're going to look at certain kinds of changes that give you a different kind of power. A different totality, a unity of action that is different in some fashion, measurably different, that gives you a different power of action than anything you had before, even in different combinations. And now you have a new metric, a new kind of number that you can say is wholly different. And what Cantor does is he shows you can generate more of these. Once you got the idea, you can generate more, and you can generate sequences of them. He's got a formal problem. But what is it that generates it? Is that I have a concept of these numbers as a whole. And out of that, I develop an idea of how I can generate something by taking the totality of these things at once.
Because that really is what I'm doing is I'm taking the totality of the list as a completed totality at once and generating a principle that allows you to, or creating a principle that allows you to generate something outside of the list. But obviously, the principle of generation is also outside of the list. Only a mind that could grasp the generative principle of the list can generate something outside the list. The list doesn't generate it. The human mind generates it. And that's this is somewhat the beginning. But here's an interesting point. I want to get one point. People who have had set theory may have a confused view of contour. Because in set theory, the way they talk about a manifold, Russell. See, what Russell did was he was out to destroy contour. So he treats a set as simply a collection of objects. And in the infamous way, he denies the concept of universality, and he says the set is just what the things that I put in this collection. And most people have thought that's what contour meant by a manifold. But if you look at the footnote here, Contour says, theory of manifolds. With this word, I designate a doctrinal concept which encompasses a great deal and which so far I have attempted to develop only in the form of an arithmetical or geometrical theory of aggregates. By a manifold or aggregate, I generally understand every multiplicity which can be thought of as one. Any totality of definite elements which by means of a law can be bounded up into a whole. And I believe that in this, I am defining something which is related to Platonic eidos, or idea, as well as to that which Plato in his dialogue Philebus calls the mikton. Anyway, there's more to go in on this, because he develops a whole concept of what an idea is. In a sense, what you get from contour is an actual idea, a principle, is something which gives you a bounded totality. And out of that, you try to develop something which is a whole new way of ordering the universe, something that gives you a new transfinite. And the question is, how do you get these things? There's a way of looking at what contour does with transfinite numbers, but you have to stick with a certain philosophical outlook or you get trapped in the formalism, which is what happened to contour. Because what you really want to do is think of this as a description of the mind generating a principle. And a principle which gives you a different organization or a way of handling the organization of the universe in a more powerful way. To do things you couldn't do before. You can think of it somewhat as a relationship between steam and electricity. As a directly applied power, or think of it as the difference between fossil fuels and nuclear fuels, where on the one hand you're dealing with the chemical reactions, on the other hand you're dealing with a different order of energy, or you could call it force, in the nucleus. These represent wholly different principles or relationships to the universe. And that's an idea. Fundamentally, those are the only kinds of ideas. Everything else is derivative. People don't like that because then they think all these wonderful ideas that they had, you mean that's not an idea? Well, it's a part of an idea. It's what comes, it's a reflection of an idea. But an idea is always a creative idea. There's not ideas and creative ideas. There's creative ideas. It's almost redundant. That's a harsh standard to a certain extent.
What about the generating principle of the difference between generating principle of real numbers and generating principle of accounting numbers? So with the real numbers, you were saying that they're generated by an actual infinite process itself, like the diameter, mm-hmm. and the circle, whereas the counting can actually be generated by finite.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where these different kinds of...
Yeah, that's part of it, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And you see it in a sense, you see it in the in a sense, the real numbers give you the power to generate this process of generating a new number every time. Now,
right.
The interesting thing I was going to tell you, just to mess it up more, is there's a funny thing that goes on. Because ask yourself, with this process of generating, there's a funny way in which, what's the how great is the gap between the counting numbers and the real numbers? Well, the gap has to be transfinite, otherwise you can count it. Okay? So it's not as though you got one more real number. I got one at a time, but I can generate it infinitely. So for however many numbers you put in there, I can always generate a new number. So, but if it's uncountable, it has to be, the difference has to be an uncountable difference. In other words, if I subtracted all the whole numbers out and all the fractions out, and all the, well, out, I would still have more left than I could count. Now, here's the interesting point. What then if? Well, the difference is the transcendental numbers. Because they're the ones that I can't construct by a finite means, so I can't count them. I can't, you know, I can't construct them by any means. You know, so how can, so I can, they're all counted. The only things I can't count are the transcendental numbers. That's all that's left. Everything else is countable. Now, how many transcendental numbers were known when Cantor generated this? Two. E and pi. So he by this proof, he demonstrated that there were a transfinite number of transcendentals, even though only two were known. And then later on, they discovered that, lo and behold, there were a lot more of them. Yeah. And that was in the late 19th century. Now, the complex numbers, you know, map one to somebody, you know, the complex numbers are representable in terms of, in different ways in terms of these numbers. But when you deal with the complex domain, you are dealing with something that's the second kind of infinite. And in fact, I think there's more that you have to look at on the complex. But Cantor compares his concept of the infinite to the complex mappings of the complex domain. But we'll go over that. I don't want to go down too many roads here. But this is the beginning point of generating the kind of idea that Lynn wants to looks back at Riemann from. This kind of generating principle. There are other problems that come up later on. We can go through different elements of what Cantor tries to do, what fails and what doesn't fail. But that's just more to investigate what this idea is.
Hey, Phil, what did you read? Did you read that campaigner from the? Oh yeah.
Yeah, I actually read it, yes.
I just had a question, because when you said that, you said how great is the gap between the real numbers and the counting numbers, you said it has to be transfinite, otherwise you could count it. So does transfinite mean that you cannot count it?
Yeah. Well, in a sense, yes. The first, in other words, let's put it this way. In order to generate more than one infinite, you have to generate something that's uncountable. And the real numbers are the first uncountable manifold that we know of.
So by transfinite, you mean something that cannot be counted in the system you're in?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Earlier you said like the pi was not constructible or something, and then you had a...
It's not constructible by a finite number of steps.
Yeah, so how do you prove that, or how do you know, or I mean, what I don't
that's
know.
Well, that's what Kuza proved first of all, back with the whole thing that he goes through about the relationship between the diameter and the circle, that it required an infinite process. Okay? And then there's a later algebraic proof in the 19th century by a guy named Hermite. Okay? So I don't have the proof off. But both of those. Yeah, no, these are historic. These are proofs that we can point to. There's Kuz's proof of the incommensurability of the circle and the polygon. Because the polygon, you know, an algebraic or a ruler and compass construction is a linear construction. Okay, and what Kuz proves is no simple set of finite set of linear steps will construct the number that's the ratio between the circle and the diameter. And then Hermite proved the same thing algebraically. Kuz did it by construction, by showing you that there was no construction. Hermite showed that there was no way of creating an algebraic expression of it. But, I mean, the difference is compare it to the square root of 2. The square root of 2 I can construct by a simple, if I take a circle of radius 1, right, I can construct the square root of 2. And I can show that that's the square root of 2. That's a finite construction. Now, what Kuz showed, and I'm not, is that there is no construction like that will give you the ratio between the diameter and the circle and the circumference. Now he did it by construction. Hermite did it by the algebraic expression for the circle.
Can you repeat that one? You said that there's no what? There's no relationship between. I guess there's not that same relationship between the circumference and what?
The circumference and the diameter, pi.
I was actually going to ask something else about earlier, about when you mentioned what Lin was doing in 1948 and 52, and then how he's come out with stuff against von Neumann and some of the other things. Like, what exactly, or I wanted you to go more into that and what he was doing around that point.
Well, this is what he was doing. In other words, he was making the point that physical economy cannot be reduced to pleasure and pain or to information. That if you reduce ideas to simple statistical data, you don't generate these kinds of ideas. You don't generate an idea that goes outside of the domain of counting numbers. Information theory is, in effect, restricted in terms of its input. It's digital. If you can digitalize it, it's countable. And that what Lin's whole point is that the creation of a new idea of a physical principle, which is what changes our relationship to nature, is something out that's an idea that generates the data. That the data doesn't generate the idea. The hypothesis, the ability of the human mind to generate a hypothesis and generate hypotheses that effectively reorganize our relationship to the universe never comes out of a simple concatenation of information. That's the point. And that's central to the physical economy. Because unless you generate new ideas, you can't change the fundamental technology in the relationship to the universe. And Lin's point is that Riemann's approach to geometry, if you add this element, that it has to come from something generated outside of the system itself, the rest is all in Riemann. Contour is a certain kind of looking back from this one development. That's something you can't generate out of information theory. And it's the center of physical economy. Because what you have to reproduce in the physical economy is human beings who can generate these kinds of ideas. Get some idea of it?
Yeah. This came up in the discussion yesterday. When whatever discussion, and Leona asked about rural electrification.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And how would you measure the effect of rural electrification upon an economy? And Jonathan threw up this idea that you'd measure it from the standpoint of the gap of one's self-conscious sense of identity of the young person before electrification and after.
Mm-hmm.
How they see themselves in relationship to the society as a whole.
Right. I mean, in a certain sense, if you're raised in this is the better side of it, but you really, the problem is, in order to fully get it, you have to know how electricity works. But the fact of the matter is, electricity gives the human species more power over nature. It's also a part of nature that you're controlling. Something that occurs in nature in a completely dangerous and uncontrollable way, if once you understand the way nature produces it, you can control it. If you grow up in a society which has that kind of power over nature, at least implicitly or potentially, you incorporate that into your sense of what human beings can do. Human knowledge can control and give you greater power over nature. So and you get the idea that human society is what produced it. So you have a sense of the power of human society. It is at least potentially an enhancement and sense an ennobling of the identity of the human individual. And a child that grows up in that environment is going to get the sense that we have that kind of control over nature. Now, it can be distorted, it can be destroyed, it can be reduced, particularly from a consumerist standpoint. If the child never has any idea that he's got to know how this works, he's just gaining the benefit of it, you in a sense have the sense of power, but not the sense of what it takes to get the power. In some ways, that's how you produce some crazy people.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Yeah, sure. It can be this. But
common mathematician today.
Yeah, but it does. It's what you have to realize is if you don't have that, you have a reduced sense of human identity across the board, and you don't change the power relations because in whatever setup you're living, if someone has a sense of power over society, they have that. So you can distort it if you don't know how it works. You have a magical sense of your control over nature. So that's a distorted version. But you start at least with you're starting with a conception of the human relationship to society, which comes out of the development of knowledge, of nature, which comes out of the development of knowledge. The question is whether the child is encouraged to replicate that knowledge. And certainly there is a pressure in it. You know, if there's any level of curiosity, the child might want to learn to reproduce knowledge. You almost have to take the curiosity out of the child. So I would look at it a little bit more that way. Most children would be curious to figure out how these things work. It's only if you tell them, don't bother, just learn the formula.
Mm.
All right.
What you finished on. And there's just something I didn't catch when you talked about what's the gap between the counting numbers and the real numbers. Were you saying that when you said that it's the transcendental numbers, are you saying that it's you take all of the real numbers, you remove from that all the integers, and you remove then all the fractions, and then all the irrationals, and you have that left?
And that's the difference, because everything else is countable.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I get that.
Well, how could? In other words, if there was only five numbers that were the difference between the counting numbers and the real numbers,
mm-hmm.
you could count them. You just need five more numbers. So how would you get something that's uncountable? It's the difference that's uncountable. So what's the difference? The whole numbers are countable. The fractions are countable. The simple irrationals are countable because you can create a formula to count the finite construction steps. Okay, so they're all countable. So what's left? the transcendentals, only those things which are not constructible in a finite number of steps.
That's what you mean by countable? Constructible in a finite number?
No, I'm saying if it's constructible in a finite number of steps, I can count it.
Because you can make that...
I can make a construction into a number. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a unique number. Mm-hmm. So I can just... however the steps are, I have a way of counting those steps. I give that number that number. That's exactly how they do it. What you do is you take the algebraic formula that gives you the finite number of steps, and you can you basically create a number that's based on that formula, and it's called the height. It's what you do is you take the coefficients and the powers. I think that's what it is, and you add them up. And it turns out every construction has a unique expression. So to that expression, you give the number of the combination of the coefficient and the powers. And that tells you what the construction is. And that's the number you ascribe to it. So it turns out that all finitely constructible or algebraically constructible numbers can be counted. So now you're left with just the transcendentals, and that's all. And there's a transfinite number of transcendentals. It tells you the transcendentals are a whole different power. Okay, that's what Leibniz and these guys come up with. Sorry, they're not the easiest ideas. Well, in one sense they're easy, but they're tricky.
Yeah.
You know, because they seem that they're a little bit. They seem to get away from you when.
Because you can always can always generate another one.
Right, it's the generative principle that makes them different.
Yeah.
They have to, there's an infinite generation that you don't get in the other ones, and it's because of the way they have to be written, constructed. Work on it. It's there. It's not that hard. It's just, it doesn't feel right. We're not used to thinking that. We think, no, it couldn't be. But that's the way everything works. I mean, think of the Parmenides. The big joke in the Parmenides. Everything has changed. It's worth looking at the Parmenides. I mean, everything is becoming. Well, wait a minute. Everything is, but Plato meant everything was precisely the generation of an idea which was a one. And as soon as you generate that idea, you have the capability for generating a new totality. And it's in that generation, the method of generation of new hypotheses, that the real existence is. It's like self-consciousness. It's in your reflection on what you've done and the history that's created you. Therefore, your ability to use your mind to generate a new idea that effectively intervenes in what history is. That's who you are. You're not all these other things that you think you are. Life is very funny because people identify with everything but what they are. The way they dress. You know, if you say to somebody, get a haircut, they get upset. It's like you're attacking them. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe you get, I don't care if they get a haircut or not. But people do all kinds of things to themselves that are supposed to identify them. They'll mark themselves up. They'll, you know, identify. They have tattoos to identify with a group. And that's who I am. Hairstyles, the new generation, the old generation, the 60s, the 70s. It's all these things that they attach to themselves, or even beliefs. Take the problem with the neurotic distortion of the creative process. What happens? Somebody's a fairly bright person, works through a few ideas, might even do a few papers that are interesting, works in the laboratory, then he has to write his dissertation, in effect. I mean, there's other things, right? He's now going to become a professional fill-in-the-blank. Okay? And to do that, he's got to carve out an area of expertise for himself or herself. And he puts it in his dissertation or whatever. That's who... Now that has become what his creative identity is. He's now certified. Therefore, if you say, wait a minute, the study that you did, that you carried out to get your PhD, your dissertation, you forgot this, you didn't do this, it really wasn't what you thought it was. the guy's going to say, no, that's not possible. That is my professional identity. And I'm not, if I change that, I wouldn't exist. I wouldn't be a professional. And that's how you get these raving people on campuses, particularly the economics professors, who go ballistic every time you try to talk to them. It couldn't be that way. And in a certain sense, it's the clarity on this that is Lynn looking back at Riemann from this discovery of contour. As I said, other stuff is more problematic.
From what I understand, the idea of the transcendental is that you're trying to look at the difference between the curved and the straight, and
yeah,
the fact that they're incommensurable. So is that kind of a way to look at the different kind of power that you're looking at?
Well, yeah, I think these are as an intuition, it's something to start with. You know, in other words, the problem is the tendency to want to reduce it down to something. I think it's even more than that, but it manifests itself as a first manifestation in that, in precisely that we're dealing with something not only, but see it, when you combine this idea of straightness and curvature, particularly when you're dealing with these transcendental actions, tractrics, evolutes and involutes, you're also into the domain of non-constant change. Because remember, even in the circle, there's non-constant change. Even though the circumference changes at a constant rate, the functional relations inside are not all constant. For example, the sine is not a constant rate of change. So the circle actually is a manifestation. The circle is really a special case of the ellipse. You got to think of it the other way around. Don't think of the ellipse as a stretched circle. It has this funny character to it, because almost all the cuts in the cone are ellipses, except for one, which is the parallel cut. So, it's only in that special case that the circumference has constant change in it. But there are still manifestations of non-constant change in the circle. And that's what comes out in pi. All right? All right.